All right, my name is Gene. I'm a fellow at the Craig Jacobs Center, and we are very honored to have this opportunity on behalf of Rusty and my collaborators, Stefan Eichner and Chris Carson, who are hiding behind at the back, to have the opportunity to present some very, very, very new, very preliminary data past month and a half. This is a picture that Chris Carson took when he was growing ES cells, just to remind you that when we are watching the cells, sometimes the cells are watching us from the dish. Okay. Okay, so this is a question that we are asking in the lab. We are interested in neuroprogenitor specification from human ESLs. We are interested in trying to get a homogeneous population of SOX1 positive, Nestin positive, SOX2 positive neuroprogenitors. Here shown is sort of our system. And more importantly, we're interested in what gene regulatory networks are important for stem cell self-renewal and or neuronal specification. Now, there are many layers of gene expression regulation, and most people are actually working on transcriptional networks here in this layer. And of course, there's a lot of interest now in chromatin epigenetic regulation. We are have been working in the past year on alternate splicing networks regulating ESL and differentiation in neuroprogenitors. And here I'm going to talk about some very new work that we've been doing over the past month, actually, on small RNAs. Small RNAs like microRNAs, piRNAs, resiRNAs are known to be quite important now in development and potentially in stem cell self-renewal and fate determination. So how do we derive small RNAs? We are using a technology that's recently developed by Solexa, now part of Illumina, and we think this is a very appropriate use of this technology. So let me just go through what we did. ES and NP cells, we derive MPs from ES. We collect RNA from these cells, 10 micrograms of RNA are run on the gel, and they are then excised here. We only extract the small RNAs from 18 to 30 bases, and these are then undergo adapter ligation followed by RT-PCR to make a double-stranded DNA library. Okay, what happens to this DNA double-stranded DNA library? Now they get put on, they get seeded onto this flow cell by Solexa and Illumina. In the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about how this actually gets done and how sequencing actually happens. This is the Solexa Illumina 1G analyzer. The throughput of this machine is rather remarkable. You can get, because there are 8 lanes on the flow cell, and at each lane, you can get about 2 million reads, about 35 nucleotides in length. So we think that the depth of sequencing will give us a lot of information into the biology, at least in the small RNA repertoire. Right, how does this work? So on the flow cell, there are adapters that are complementary to the adapters that are ligated onto your small RNAs. These are seeded randomly on the flow cell. And what happens is that you denature your double-stranded DNA library, you hybridize it onto the adapters on the flow cell, and then fluorescently labeled nucleotides are incubated with the sample DNA polymerase, or a mutant form of it, adds one base at a time. And so each cycle you add for these millions of clusters on your lawn, one nucleotide, right? And then the laser with 2 channels each reads for each cycle A, C, G, or T, right? So you get for each, for one cycle, you get 4 pictures, right? 4 pictures, and each picture corresponds to millions of clusters. And each cluster tells you for that one cycle, what that nucleotide is for that position. And so you can basically go up to 35 bases currently, and you get about 2 to 3 million clusters per lane in each flow cell. Right, so then when you open your computer, right, and you get about 4 million reads. So we actually got 4 million reads from ESLs and 4 million reads from our neuroprogenitors. What do you do with this, right? Most people, we were kind of afraid of the sequencing, but we were very excited to see that we actually got a lot of small RNAs. What do you do next? Well, okay, it's just for in terms of technical reasons, it's important to specify a minimum length because you get otherwise many non-unique hits in the human genome for 15 bases or less. So we said, well, let's be stringent and get 18 bases as a cutoff, and so that reduces the number to about 3 million each from ES and MPs. And then you map them to the human genome. Uniquely, you try to remove things that hit the genome 1,000 times, even at 18 bases. And so you get about 1 million reads in ES and about 2 million reads in MP cell. So then how do you analyze this deluge of data, right? So we started coming up with a method to do this. So we asked, let's try to collect somewhat non-unique reads, right? So filter reads that hit the genome 5 times or less. And then we cluster the reads. So a lot of reads overlap one another, right? So you can cluster them and define unique clusters in the genome. So we get about 78,000 clusters in ES and MP in total. And you can sort of break them up into three groups. I'll be sort of showing you one or two slides of analysis from each group here in this talk. So for example, you get about 28,000 clusters that overlap known RNAs, so microRNAs, small piRNAs, tRNAs, ribosomal RNAs, yeah, sort of RNA and repeat-associated RNAs. And then you have about a fraction of them here, a third that fall into sort of non-annotated regions. We don't know what they are, right? They don't fall in genes. They don't fall in annotated small RNA regions as well. And then the majority of them are within genes. So they fall within the promoter, within the exons and introns, right? And on average, just to give you an idea, each cluster is made up of a bunch of reads, right? There are sort of unique and non-overlapping in space. So this is 40 reads per cluster you get, 2 reads per cluster, and a read per cluster here. So now I'm going to focus mainly on those small RNAs that overlap known RNAs, right, and repeat-associated RNAs, and ask, what are they? It turns out that a majority of them, 3/4 of them, fall into what we call a repeat-associated class, things that are, so these are a diversity of the small RNAs, and we're sort of trying to understand what these are still. But we're happy to see that we actually get a small fraction of them that are actually annotate, these non-redundant clusters fall into annotated known mature microRNAs. And in this sort of 1 month, in 2 runs, we picked up 70% of all known mature microRNAs out there. It's been collected over 5 years. So that was quite exciting. What about abundance? So those are non-redundant reads. What about abundance? So the small fraction of microRNAs make up basically 90% or more of the reads of the small RNAs that are annotated in known RNAs and repeat-associated regions. Okay, so something interesting about the technology, the depth of sequencing is so good that you can basically plot for each small RNA number of counts it occurs in, say, ES cells, and number of counts it occurs in neuroprogenitor cells. Sorry. And just use that as a measure of abundance. So if you do this, you can actually reliably compute pseudo microarray expression profiles of small RNAs that are highly expressed in ES cells and are highly expressed in neuroprogenitor cells. Just as 2 examples here, which are microRNAs. This is miR-302D, which you can see has 5,000 counts in ES cells that we see as reads, right? And not a single count at all in neuroprogenitor cells. And LET7, as you know, is important for neuronal differentiation, has 400,000 counts in neuroprogenitor cells and about 100 counts in ES cells. So the dynamic range of this technology is quite amazing. Okay, what can we do with this? Sorry, this is just to remind me to explain what these colors are. This is an annotated microRNA in the UCSC genome browser. This is the mature microRNA here. And so we can sort of see that each of these represents a read that we sequenced. The ones in red are sequenced from ES cells. The ones in green are sequenced from neuroprogenitors, and blue is a different cell line. But you can sort of see that we pick up the annotated microRNA, right, the mature microRNA here. But because of the depth of sequencing, we can also pick up the mere star, right, in this case. Things have not been annotated, but we definitely see it. This is very different from using microarray technologies to pick up microRNA profiles because you have to pre-design them. And here you don't. You just sequence and you count and see where they land. We also pick up unique processing products, likely from Drasha, that actually overlap the microRNA but hasn't been seen in vivo, at least, before. So we picked up 198 unique processing products that we can use to then understand the rules of microRNA processing. Well, you can sort of tell that if you just use the signature, right? You have paired columns of reads for a microRNA, so this is a known microRNA, you can use this to find novel microRNAs without using conservation in the genome, which is what most microRNA gene prediction algorithms use. This is actually a microRNA that's specific for human ES cells and not even in any other organisms. So we can use this signature to find novel microRNAs. And it turns out that we can find 600 novel putative microRNAs just by this signature, these two columns of reads, force in a hairpin, very strong base pairing. And we've doubled the number of microRNAs that we know of. All right. So that's actually part of the unknown category, right? So we've annotated some of them as novel microRNAs now. But then we have a lot of non-annotated stuff, right, that is some of them are highly conserved across genomes. They're definitely sequenced many times. They are not ribosomal RNA, tRNA fragments. They're sort of novel RNAs, and we have a whole population of them now that we don't know what they do, but they're all very interesting to us to look at, see if there's any functional meaning. What about the ones that fall in genes? Right, this is close to the end. We're saying, well, okay, so those that fall in genes, what do they look like? So let's take a look at two examples here, right? This is one gene. This is a known gene in the human genome. This is the start site of the gene. It's transcribing this way. This is the first exon, the first intron. And you can sort of see that there are small RNAs here, and the little arrows show you which direction they're going. So these are transcribing sense to the gene, right? And some of them are transcribing antisense to the gene. Note that the ones that are transcribing antisense to the gene are actually upstream of the start site. This is another example, which actually we don't have antisense ones here, but we do have a lot of sense small RNAs are transcribing downstream of the start site. Is this true globally? This is kind of interesting. We see that small RNAs, there are sense, they're within genes, there are sense to the genes, are actually a little bit downstream of the start site, which is at zero. And so these are the population that is sense to the gene. But then you see this unique population of small RNAs that are also antisense to the promoters. And this is, we're not sure what this means, but this is definitely something that we're interested in looking at. Okay, so just quick findings and future directions. We found a very complex set of small RNAs, and in 2 months we picked up a lot of novel microRNAs. These are reliable counts. You can use them as just raw counts. You don't have to worry about microarray hybridization artifacts anymore. And we are planning to study some of the microRNAs that are important. They're differentially enriched in ES and MP cells. But also integrate our expression data from our alternative splicing studies to identify targets of particular microRNAs. So we're excited about using the Selexa technology to do other applications as well. This is sort of an acknowledgement slash slide about ongoing applications of Selexa and Illumina that we're doing in the lab. So of course, we need to thank Rusty and CIRM and Jacob Center. This is very close collaboration with Stefan and Chris Carson in the back of the room. They are here to answer questions. I can recruit them. And we're also using Selexa to look at alternate splicing in the lab, where retrotransposable elements fall into the genome, as well as where RNA binding proteins are bound to in the genome. And these are the students that are working very hard in the lab. Thanks very much.
In order to stay on time and give everybody enough time for lunch and start the panel in the afternoon, I think we'll entertain just one question and then move on to our last speaker. Is there a burning question on either side of the room? No?
Yep.
Okay.
What's the smallest sort of fragment that you can detect in a cell?
Reliably, or whether or not we can.
Well, I'm sort of wondering if you want to go to a single cell level, you know, go from the population, molecule approach to cell detection to get some headway on determining biological
reasons. Right. So the nice thing about this technology is that you don't really have to do a lot of amplifications prior to putting the samples onto the flow cell. So if you could get, you could technically do single cell. RNA, profiling on this because you don't really need a huge amount of amplification. The amplification is only there to give you the signal of what the read is, but not necessarily to give you more samples, right? There won't be as much sample bias.
Yeah.